Welcome back to the Mining Pod. On today's show, we're joined by Dylan LeClaire, a Bitcoin analyst at Bitcoin Magazine Pro. Dylan and I talk about the security budget debate raging on Twitter these days, macro cycles for Bitcoin, and how future flows could end up in miners' pockets. Did you know that you can make more money by merge mining other networks? Check out makemoremoneymining.com for information on BIPs 300 and 301, a proposal to bring more revenue to Bitcoin miners through sidechains and merge mining called drive chains. Increase your mining revenues and learn more about participating in Bitcoin governance by visiting makemoremoneymining.com. Are you a miner who wants to activate Bitcoin improvements? Check out activation.watch. See what Bitcoin improvements the Bitcoin community, developers, and miners are considering and show support by signaling for one of many BIPs up for consideration. Activation.watch. Filecoin's mission is to create decentralized, efficient, and robust storage infrastructure for humanity's information. Join the Filecoin Foundation team October 3rd through 5th for Phil Vegas, the first major Filecoin community event in North America in 2023, to explore how to adapt data storage for an AI-centric future. Participate in conversations and hear keynotes focus on the importance of data integrity in the world of artificial intelligence. Register to attend and learn more at phil-vegas.io and make sure to use promo code MININGPOD.
Hey, Mining Pod, I'm Lee Bratcher, president of the Texas Blockchain Council. The Texas Blockchain Summit is now the North American Blockchain Summit. The same emphasis on policy, energy, and Bitcoin mining, but now expanded by working with our partners across the country. We've got great sponsors lined up like Riot, Marathon, GDA, CleanSpark, Bitdeer, Lancium, Cormint, Compass, HTS, Crypto Power, Priority Power, Sonoda, and many more. Solidify your next deal or JV, or just come for the networking on November 15th through 17th in Fort Worth, Texas, for the third annual North American Blockchain Summit. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to the Mining Pod. We got Dylan LeClaire on the show. Dylan, you are fresh off a hot tweet, and you're getting pummeled online, being called a pigeon, among other things. Welcome to the show. I'm excited to dive into it. It's a really immaculate timing.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here, Will. Definitely good timing to be on a Mining Pod.
Yeah, so for those who are not on Twitter, Dylan went out and gave his thoughts on Bitcoin tail emissions. I'll let you summarize it. I guess we could possibly play the video in a second here, but I'll let you summarize it.
Yeah, I mean, the core of the argument is, you know, Bitcoin right now and, you know, throughout its history is, you know, its miner compensation model has been predominantly block subsidy, right? New coin issuance entering circulation. That total supply is kind of like on an asymptote. So right now, like, you know, 19.5 million Bitcoin, there will only ever be 21 million. And with each halving, that miner issuance gets cut in half. So the debate, the topic at hand is, well, in, you know, X amount of halvings, Bitcoin's going to become insecure. It's going to, you know, the threat is that it becomes trivial to attack the network. And what does that attack look like? Well, a 51% attack. Aside from, you know, I guess, well, the double spend is one, right, where, you know, I'm a miner, I send you coins, I reorg, I basically rewrite that transaction, and the coins you thought you had, you don't have. The other ones are, you know, say this is like a state actor of sorts. Never mind the fact that, you know, this is assuming that 51% of the, there's a lot of assumptions in all of this, right? Like kind of both camps, or maybe there's like, you know, three, four camps in this debate. It's all really unfalsifiable, right? It's just like kind of theoretical, and that's like kind of what makes it fun. But, you know, this is assuming that, you know, a state actor has, or some actor has, 51% of the physical ASICs, you know, and a lot of people will point to pools and say, well, two pools have, you know, all the hash power, or 50% of the hash power, or, you know, this X percent. And, you know, that obviously I think is a little bit, it's not misinformed, but the wrong take, because the ASICs aren't physically located there. They aren't physically domiciled there, but that's another topic. But let's just say, hypothetically, they get the ASICs, right? The U.S. government goes to all these public miners, you know, men with guns roll in, and they say, okay, well, you know, this is ours now. The threat model is, well, one of two things. One is like kind of the half-baked threat attack is like, you know, it's only white market Bitcoin transactions that are allowed in the, you know, like maybe OFAC, non-compliant transactions, black market transactions, non-KYC transactions are censored, right? And any miner that mines those will get basically reorgs, or, you know, those will get kind of like stale orphan blocks, and the majority censored transaction or censored hash rate miner will continue to kind of mine that white market. And then the other one is, you know, in a world where there's no block subsidy whatsoever, the miner will just mine completely empty blocks and basically DDoS attack the network is another, you know, kind of like hypothetical threat model. And so for me, you know, I guess the argument that the reason I went into essentially my argument in the video was saying that a difficulty adjustment is a self-correcting, self-reinforcing mechanism in Bitcoin, where, you know, if it's, you know, not profitable for miners to mine Bitcoin, they're going to temporarily unplug. Blocks are going to slow down. There's going to be slower transaction finality. There's going to be a clog in the mempool queue. People are going to pay higher transactions fees to get into the next block. And oftentimes we see with these fee spikes that higher fees beget higher fees, right? Because there's like similar to like the Ordinals BRC20 craze, where like not only were these BRC20 tokens paying all sorts of fees, but anybody that was like actually economically using Bitcoin just to send value, not like the Ordinals thing, also paid massive amounts of fees. So, I mean, I didn't really go into this much depth in the video, which maybe was the cause of the controversy. But my thoughts on the matter is that in, you know, these hypothetical threat scenarios, never mind the fact that I think actually ASICs will continue to decentralize as hash rate continues to go up, as hash price continues to go down in BTC and USD terms, most likely, as has been the trend for the entire history of the network, that ASICs will actually continue to decentralize, and that the block subsidy, one could argue that the block subsidy is maybe even a centralizing force in miners, and that you're not going to see these massive megawatt farms in a world where, you know, the profit from mining Bitcoin, you know, it's like basically scattered to the lowest, maybe even free cost of energy around the world, which is, I guess, another avenue to go off of. But my thought is that in a world, right, where there's no longer a block subsidy and it's just fees, you're essentially, there's like the idea of the aggregate security budget as a dude is almost a flawed way to look at it. And individuals pay for their own security budget via fees, right? So if someone is censoring the network, right, you know, and whether it's economic or not, maybe a state actor wouldn't be economic. Well, the people that are being censored, whether it's everybody or just the black market transactors, are going to pay 10x, 100x, 1000x the fee rate to get into the next block. And the whole idea of Bitcoin, the thing that like makes this work, the game theory of it, is like economic incentives. And so if you like, if not you, but if someone thinks like, well, this, you know, isn't going to work, well, then I think, you know, Bitcoin has been doomed to fail. I guess that's the argument, right? It's like, well, Bitcoin's always been doomed because the economic incentives won't prevail. And my opinion is that it will, right? And so like, even then, right, if you think that and you think, well, you know, the people that are, you know, going to be censored won't be able to counter this with like a massive increase in fees they're paying, right? And the economic incentives won't prevail and cause more hash rate to come online to mine those black market transactions. Well, in that case, if you believe that, which, you know, believe what you will, I don't believe that the 1 or 2% fee emission on top of that solves anything to begin with, right? Like, oh, well, you know, these miners are going to be uneconomic. They're going to ignore all this massive spike in fees from the black market actors. Great. You know, think that, whether, you know, it's just the state that has the money printer that doesn't care about the Bitcoin fees. Well, in that case, what does the 1 or 2% fee emission even solve, right? So I gave you a whole bunch of stuff there. That's my kind of long-winded thoughts. And I have, you know, more to go on if you want to dig deeper. But does that make sense, or did I just go on a random tangent?
No, I love that. I like the facial expressions there at the end too. And I think the fee emission thing.
What are your thoughts?
What
are your thoughts?
We're obviously not going to solve the fee emission problem here on this.
We're going to solve it podcast right here. We are. We're going to get to the bottom of it. Well,
yeah. If you can open the terminal on my laptop, then that would itself be impressive. So, okay, let's break it down into like sections. The first part is like the emission schedule debate sort of centers around like short-term reorgs and long-term reorgs, or that's how I like to break it down. And yeah, we could get more nuanced with it, but the short-term reorgs is like the tip of the chain. We're worried about like the first one, two or three blocks constantly being reorged as like a pool or another mining entity on there wants to keep reorging the chain, so you can't like really settle a transaction. And like the longer term reorgs, right, is like, hey, let's go back 5-6 blocks and just keep fundamentally changing the chain, or let's keep forcing people to build on a certain chain that doesn't include a lot of transactions. So you mentioned like the empty blocks. That could be one sort of longer term attack I like to think of. And then you also mentioned like a state attack where they're like forcing you to, they're censoring transactions that do not comply. So that's how I sort of break it down. I think the second version, like the longer attacks with 51% attacks, those are less likely. And I also don't think that like the fee situation really negates that issue, because it's a much larger task, right? If someone was going to try to attempt that, they already have a ton of money and there's already something fundamentally broken. But the short-term reorgs is the thing that I think that's a little bit more interesting, right? And if we're relying on the fees to incentivize like the first one, two, three blocks at the tip of the chain to be processed correctly and for people to build on top of them, well, we might have some issues because fees actually might be too high or too low. And I think this kind of gets to like maybe the like the point of your argument here, which is we don't know what we don't know. And a lot of times the modeling around these things is just completely speculative, right? And so for right now, we don't have a rationale or a reason to say that Bitcoin's model is wrong. We have some papers out there. I think Hasu and James Prestwich issued something in 2019 that was really interesting around like how Bitcoin it might have potential MEV in the future. That's a really important paper. There's been some other talks about this. Ethereum people obviously have been working on this a lot because they're bought into the idea that the security budget is an issue.
Yep.
But right now we don't know what we don't know. But I'd be curious what you think about like that tip of the chain issue, right? Where we're like, we might have issues with short-term reorgs because we're relying on a world where there's just fees and there's no Coinbase subsidy. Do you think there could be an issue there in say like 20, 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, this is like another kind of avenue of the debate, but, and again, this is, you know, really like this entire thing is speculative. Like the even the notion of like security budget being too low or too high is like, well, okay, you know, what's the threshold? And there is none, right? It's just like a, like the I guess like what some people would say, the laser-eyed maximalist crowd, which is like, I don't like to be kind of grouped into, you know, or like, you know, siloed.
You do have laser eyes on Twitter.
I do. So I guess so. I'm a laser eyed, you know, maximalist that hasn't thought about this stuff. But I guess like when I think of Bitcoin in 2023, even, you know, like 14 years post launch, it's like a bet on Bitcoin, even, you know, heading into the fourth halving is still just a bet on Bitcoin's monetization. Right. And so like,
yeah.
So, you know, the Ethereum people would say, well, yeah, no one's using the chain, and like, or you know, not the, just the Ethereum people, but the people in like the security budget concern side is like, and, you know, okay, let's extrapolate this out. And then, you know, miners are getting like, you know, X million dollars in the future, and there's no way a $1 trillion network can sustain itself at that. And my sort of thing is like, well, I think this is just like part of the monetization arc of Bitcoin. And like, if you extrapolate it out in 2011, what the fee model would look like, or 2014 or 2017 or 2020 or 2023, like it looks different every single time. And so even like the people that were, you know, that are championing like the concern right now, like we're making fun of Taproot in 2021. And now like Taproot's the next best thing, and like ordinals are going to save the security model. So like it's, the like, I guess my argument, or maybe even lack thereof, is like it's an unknown, and like concern trolling about like, oh, you know, like Bitcoin's doomed or it's gonna need fees or whatever, and like saying like almost like a neo-Keynesian, like we need 2% inflation to, and like that will be the solution. And then it's like, well, and this was part of like the block or the fork wars debate in 2017, is like the people that were saying no to SegWit 2x were saying like, no, this opens up a can of worms, like of like, oh, you know, but this fork actually makes it better. And so it's like, oh, well, you know, 21 million Bitcoin. No, that's Bitcoin will actually, you know, have an issue and a perpetual issue. It's like Dogecoin or something. And that will be like the solution to our issues. And it's like, well, that's your idea, or that's your like opinion. Right. And so,
yeah,
like, again, this is literally all hypothetical. You know, the I guess the camps are like do nothing, fork, hard fork, emissions, perpetual, whatever. And the third kind of like maybe like second B camp is like, we just have to like maximize block space usage, which I agree with. And my opinion is like, yeah, that's going to come anyway. If you believe that this thing is going to monetize and isn't just going to, like if Bitcoin just stagnates forever right here, then like the current amount of energy usage and mining, you know, security, if you will, is fine where it is. And if Bitcoin is going to, you know, 10x, 100x, well, there's 100x basically wasted energy in the world that's not being monetized right now. So like, and that could be, that could be monetized at like basically zero cost. And the race for that like profit or that revenue is like literally going to be racing to zero. Like the idea that, you know, we're going to have like these like 1 billion megawatt mining farms on a grid in 30 years is like wrong in my opinion. It's going to be like, and again, that's just my opinion, but it's like, you're going to have, you know, layered methane that's going to be combusted in mining Bitcoin. You're going to have Bitcoin, you know, in Africa on like a, you know, makeshift dam that's being mined. And like, that's, and so just like, kind of like, you know, quantifying this stuff and modeling it. And it's like, feels very like Keynesian to me. And my whole argument was like, was just like literally mansplaining. Eric was like, you're mansplaining the difficulty adjustment. And I responded, yeah, exactly. Was just like, it's a self-correcting mechanism. And
yeah,
I'm not too worried. So maybe that's naive. Maybe I'm just, you know, haven't looked into it enough or something, but that's my thing.
Brain dead laser eye. Yeah. No, one thing I wanted to jump into there is talking about like the difficulty adjustment, which basically like your whole video is like premise on that, right? So as the network increases, people are going to use it more, but as like mining becomes harder, people will drop off a network in terms of mining, and that'll lead to like fee pressurization as like there's slower block times and people still want to use the network. And we'll come back to like an equilibrium, which I do think is like a very fair market argument. The question that was pushed against you, and I think you someone answered this, but 1% attack comes as you start lowering the difficulty, right? As like difficulty drops 25%, 50%, as all these miners start to leave. And that's where there could be some pain points. And we've seen some arguments around that. Justin Drake, who's an Ethereum Foundation guy, is we've had him on this show too, talk about this, where, you know, if you were a state actor who wanted to attack the chain, you would wait until the worst bear market mining time ever, right? You'd wait until difficulty just lowers a lot and then you're able to pick up cheap ASICs. So I think like there is an argument there. What are your thoughts on that, like that moment where there could be like a 51% attack and put the network in jeopardy?
Yeah. So how I'm thinking about it is if there's this sort of 51% attack, whether it's like just a straight up DDoS of no transactions or, you know, orphaning off any, you know, Bitcoin blocks with, you know, non-KYC sort of blacklist transactions in it, is that this, you know, this fork off or this, you know, this 51% attack where, you know, that malicious actor is consistently mining their own blocks or, you know, continuing to rewrite the chain, that's going to also send hash rate a lot lower because none of the non-malicious actors blocks are being mined, right? So all of a sudden, you know, this actor is, you know, 51% mining, and then the other one, the good actor, if you will, isn't, which was going to send difficulty a whole lot lower anyway. Meanwhile, in theory, you know, the transactions in the mempool from like the black market fees are going to literally be skyrocketing and just continuing to build and build and build and build and build. And that, in my argument, only went surface level, as in like, oh, well, when you know, blocks slow down, you know, fees are going to build up. But this does, I didn't even dive into like, well, if there's like an actively known malicious attacker that's censoring transactions, it's not even just going to be a buildup. You're going to see fees absolutely soar. And at the same time, difficulty is going to have to just plummet because, you know, say like, you know, 50% of blocks or the hash rate's only basically 50% of what it should be because of that malicious actor is continuing to rewrite the chain. And so, you know, my response is like, well, it's going to be a market correcting mechanism where that honest hash rate is going to have, one, the massive incentive to mine the blocks, and two, the difficulty is going to drop tremendously. And there's all this old gen equipment out there, right? Like if you believe Moore's law, and maybe it tapers off, maybe it doesn't, which is another kind of twist to this whole argument of like, well, yeah, maybe they do have 50% of the hash rate now, but like, you know, the next gen of ASICs is going to be even faster, which is like another one of these like unknown unknowns that nobody can factor into all of this. Well, you know, when difficulty adjusts lower and there's this, you know, massive monstrosity of a mempool with all of these fees that we've never seen before because of just, you know, how blatant the censorship regime is, there's just, you know, this natural market-based incentive to be honest. And so like, if the argument is like, well, you know, there's not, you know, that economic incentive and the game theory of all this and the profit incentive like isn't enough, like, I guess that's your argument. My argument is that like, no, the economic incentives will prevail. And even if there is, you know, temporary reorg, you know, for some time, well, it'll be a naturally correcting mechanism. And over the long run, you know, I guess maybe if it's funded with a state money printer or whatnot, but over the long run, the honest actors are going to benefit getting paid in Bitcoin. And, you know, that will result in them obviously, you know, getting more profit or more revenue. I guess the other take is like, and I don't really know how I feel about this because it's not really like the ethos of Bitcoin, but you know, like I guess maybe Andreas's take, there's that really like that old video of him talking about like what would happen if, you know, someone 51% attacked Bitcoin. And he's like, oh, well, we would, you know, identify them and then we'd, you know, fork off and just kind of go to the last block that before the censorship. And, you know, they'd have mined a bunch of worthless blocks and wasted all this money and they could have just made Bitcoins. And so I guess that also is an argument where like, you know, the good actors and everybody could be like, well, let's go to, you know, five blocks back or, you know, block tip, you know, XYZ. And, you know, we'll kind of all just agree. And the market, similar to like how a fork works, like Bcash, Bitcoin, it's like, ah, well, the market decides that this is the valuable chain. I guess that's also an argument, which is like, you know, I guess goes against the ethos of like, well, the longest chain is the chain, but a bunch of different avenues to go down.
Yeah, definitely. And so let's leave it here so we don't beat it to death. Thanks for the explanation. What do you think about like the reaction to your tweet? Because I think we're like in the depths of a bear market and people are really bored and people are like pretty nasty online. And so I was kind of surprised to see this pop off because like we talk about security budget forever, right? Like it's almost a boring topic at this point because it just keeps coming back around. But tweet kind of hit the right people in the right way. And I'm curious, like, why you think that actually happened?
I mean, yeah, it's a heated debate. I had my fair share of hot takes and you know, back and forth with like the, you know, the maximalists and like the, you know, the crypto agnostic like multi chain people. I mean, I don't care. Like, it's the arena of ideas. Like, roast me. You know, it's like I'm not gonna whimper or hide away or whatnot. I posted it. It was my last tweet of the night. I logged off, put on Do Not Disturb, and then went to dinner, and came back, and then this morning logged on and was like, oh wow,
oh shoot.
So yeah, no, it's like I mean, it's great. I think discussion's great. I'm willing to defend my ideas, and if it's wrong, let's talk about it. I mean, I don't think it is. I just think the notion of like, oh, you know, this is a problem and I have a centrally planned solution. It's like, yeah, do you though? So yeah, let's talk about it, you know, roast me, agree with me. Like, it was kind of funny. It was like either like genius or like you're a fucking moron, and there was literally no in between, which is great, you know. Like I love it. But
I'm trying to give you the centrist position here on the show.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Trying to do that for you. Yeah, no, like just to respond to that really quickly, I think the thing that irks non-laser-eyed folks is the certainty of laser-eyed folks of like how like they're certain that Bitcoin doesn't need any change in security budget or doesn't need any change from what it is right now. And on the flip side, right, we have like the whole you're trying to make Bitcoin a shitcoin, you're trying to change things. And I would love to see more of like the centrist position where it's like, hey, we should just like have a conversation around what this means. But I think that is always ruined because someone comes with some sort of solution. So like Peter Todd comes with like this 2% inflation solution, and he has like a whole thing around it, right? Where he's like, we could take old coins that haven't moved in a while and reprogram those. But I always think that kind of ruins the conversation, right? Because like someone comes with a solution, then all of a sudden that solution is the focus instead of like the intended argument of there being a problem.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I'm more in that camp than like maybe my tweet or like my profile picture would lead to believe. In the sense that, like, no, there's a bunch of unknown unknowns, and anybody that speaks with like absolute certainty of like for me, I'm like, okay, tell me what the right security budget is, or like, tell me where fees will be, or like it's like, yeah. Okay, I'm going to assume the market cap, and I'm going to assume the fees in BTC terms, and I'm going to assume the hash rate and the difficulty, and I'm going to also assume that ASICs aren't going to be geographically distributed, or they are, and it's like,
yeah,
and then it's like, oh, with all that said, you know, I have a solution. And also a certain fix to this problem. And it's like, oh, my solution is like, I don't know, but we have the closest thing to like a correct, you know, a correction mechanism, a self-reinforcing mechanism, that is the difficulty adjustment and a free market solution. So, you know, Bitcoin doesn't monetize and no one knew Bitcoin, like what Satoshi said, essentially, not that he's like some god, but he's like, if no one's using, it's like either a whole bunch of people are using Bitcoin in 20 years, or I forget if he said 10 or 20. Or they're not.
Yeah.
And if no one's using Bitcoin on chain in 20 years from now, then like something went wrong. And, you know, I guess that's like that's my stance on it.
Are you a retail or institutional investor interested in Bitcoin mining companies? The Miner Mag brings you free data and analysis from all major NASDAQ listed Bitcoin mining operations to know who stands out. Check out visualized metrics and data dependent stories at theminermag.com.
Did you know that you can make more money by merge mining other networks? Check out makemoremoneymining.com for information on BIPs 300 and 301, a proposal to bring more revenue to Bitcoin miners through sidechains and merge mining called drive chains. Increase your mining revenues and learn more about participating in Bitcoin governance by visiting makemoremoneymining.com. Are you a miner who wants to activate Bitcoin improvements? Check out activation.watch. See what Bitcoin improvements the Bitcoin community, developers, and miners are considering and show support by signaling for one of many BIPs up for consideration. Activation.watch. Filecoin's mission is to create decentralized, efficient, and robust storage infrastructure for humanity's information. Join the Filecoin Foundation team October 3rd through 5th for Phil Vegas, the first major Filecoin community event in North America in 2023 to explore how to adapt data storage for an AI-centric future. Participate in conversations and hear keynotes focus on the importance of data integrity in the world of artificial intelligence. Register to attend and learn more at phil-vegas.io and make sure to use promo code MININGPOD.
Cool. Okay, let's move over to Riga. You were there last week and you gave an awesome presentation about macro cycles and flows into Bitcoin. I think the correct framing or summary of your talk was, we have this four-year cycle with Bitcoin. It's proven out pretty consistently, and a lot of people have thought of it in terms of halving, and then you model it according to like M2 money flows for like world M2. Walk us through that a little bit, and then we're going to move over to like how that plays into Bitcoin mining. Certainly a lot of people listening to the show are interested about how, like, once Bitcoin capitalizes, the mining side of things will rebound. Maybe we can even get some hopium for Bitcoin miners right now who are not doing so hot.
Yeah, no, I used to be like much more of a halving, like when I kind of first went into Bitcoin, it was like a halving, you know, kind of drives everything. You know, the stock to flow model was like rather intuitive. It wasn't gospel, but it was just like something cool to visualize. Increasingly, as I've like studied the protocol, I think it's much, much less. I mean, and obviously with each halving, the role it plays diminishes. But in my opinion, right now, like I think at least going forward, like the halving from like a price action standpoint is more of like, you know, paradoxically is more of like a demand driver than a supply driver, in the sense that like, yeah, supply, you know, margin at the margin diminishes a bit. And, you know, those flows do add up. But really, if you kind of like, you know, check the chain DM, there's much more coins flowing back and forth, you know, flooding onto exchanges, coming off from exchanges. The interplay between like, you know, long-term holders, the coins that don't get spent, and like probabilistically, the longer they're held, the less likely they are to get spent, versus the coins that are just continuing to change hands, that kind of like free float. Like that's what's driving the actual cycles. It's like the interplay of like, okay, this thing is this supply is extremely constrained. Money flows in. Bitcoin seemingly like randomly so to the outside observer goes parabolic, you know, part of that is driven by the macro side. Even when Bitcoin was smaller, just kind of like the kind of the flows of the business cycle, in my opinion, and risk on, risk off, and increasingly so as Bitcoin becomes larger and more ingrained in the global balance sheet. But, you know, paradoxically so, or maybe like in the earlier cycles, it was a bit much bigger driver. It lined very well up, very nicely with the halving. So like the narrative is like having number go up. And like, you know, I think, who knows, like Bitcoin could very well, you know, pump this time around, you know, ETF, you know, other side of a recession, maybe like money printer. There's all these other, you know, conflicting narratives. But like to think that like we have all of this data out there, we have an entire UTXO set to analyze. Bitcoin is increasingly becoming interconnected and correlated with equities and bonds and volatility and the dollar. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, this like supply issuance, you know, this like change in the code, just like switches and Bitcoin just like programmed to go number go up, I think is like a very simplistic way to look at it. So yeah, I mean, I think like the macro correlation, one of the main points of my talk was like, you know, from some of the like hyper maximalist people, it's like, you know, screw the BlackRock and the financialization of Bitcoin. Like, you know, screw the suits. This is bad. A financialization is bad. And my argument is like, yeah, I mean, if you want to think that, great, but Bitcoin's permissionless. And the way that Bitcoin goes from a $500 billion drop in the bucket, nothing asset, not nothing, right? You know, $500 billion significant. But the way that like, you know, how to reach where a lot of these Bitcoiners like think, even like the far, far like right side of like the distribution curve of like outcomes of like hyper Bitcoinization. Like, well, how does that happen? Right. It's like these guys, these boomers with like trillions upon trillions of capital coming in, and they're not going to like buy on Coinbase and then send it to their multi-sig wallet and then coin join. Like they're just going to buy Larry Fink's ETF. And so like, that's, I guess that was my like argument of it, is like, this isn't a bad thing. This is like how TradFi, at least initially, is going to come in. And like, it's, you know, in my opinion, should be embraced, right? Like you can still do like the cyberpunk kind of like Bitcoin native maximalist sort of things. But like, this is how the you know, quote unquote suits are going to access Bitcoin.
Yeah, definitely. So when I listen to that talk, the first thing that came to my mind is like, we do have exposure ways for the suits right as of now, or like mom and dad's 401ks to get exposure to Bitcoin. And that's oftentimes through Bitcoin mining stocks, which right now is like a market cap of like $8 billion, give or take.
Yeah.
And that can inflate like rapidly. So I think Marathon Digital's market cap is like $2 billion right now. And that's pretty small compared to where it was the top of last cycle. I think it was $8 billion itself last November 2021. And that was with less shares outstanding by a significant margin.
Yep.
So I'd be curious how you think about that. Like, where are these like mining stocks going to go? To me, it seems like obviously not financial advice. And I have to throw in that like infamous cringy line. But I think that's where a lot of these flows are going to go. I'd be curious for your like thoughts on how that plays out.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, Bitcoin miners, just given the lack of, or like, you know, the kind of the illiquidity of the market caps. I mean, it's really hard to, I mean, $8 billion is nothing, right? Like it's hard to put, you know, it's hard to move $50 million into these things. And also, I guess just one narrative that I like kind of want to like nip in the bud before we dig into it is like, I see all the time, and I've commented on it a little bit, but it's like, BlackRock is accumulating. And it's like, guys, BlackRock passively indexes into every company on the NASDAQ and S&P 500. So them buying a Marathon or, you know, go down the list is just them like passively buying on behalf of their NASDAQ ETF clients, or maybe like, you know, they have other, you know, ETF buckets, but BlackRock is not like actively preparing for the halving and like loading up, right? It's just they're doing on behalf of clients to collect fees. So to dig into it a bit more, I think Bitcoin miners, yeah, obviously like, you know, hyper volatile. And if you just look at like how they trade and you put like a, you know, just account for the realized volatility of these things, the sharp ratio is essentially, I mean, it depends a bit on where they are in cycle, but we have a limited data set, but sharp ratio is basically in tandem with Bitcoin. So what does that mean? You know, the fact that like in a bull market, they go up, last bull market, they went up like some of them 50X, even more. It's like, well, these things are just levered Bitcoin to the hilt, right? It's just like, and they are, right? They're levered on their balance sheet. They have liabilities. The ASICs are also, you know, essentially an expression of Bitcoin's price. Some of them took on like ASIC collateralized loans, all of this. So like they do trade like, you know, levered Bitcoin, and that's why in a bull market, they get killed. I do think like in the next bull market, whenever it may be, really in any bull market, in a hash price bull market, when miner revenue per terahash or per unit of hash rate is increasing, you want to own the miners. And obviously that's completely dependent on the Bitcoin price, and that trends lower over time. But, you know, when in a bull market, or especially, you know, like coming out of a bear, these just a small change in the Bitcoin price can massively expand the margins on these miners. So like, I think honestly, from like a security budget debate, talk about like how public miners business models will change, or if it'll even be like a viable thing of like, you know, this centralized massive, you know, owner of hash rate, you know, in one place or a few different facilities. Like that's, you know, almost not more of an interesting debate, but like you can maybe like think about the viability of five, you know, four halvings from now, three halvings from now, five from now. Like, will these massive conglomerate miners be a thing, or will it be much, much more decentralized at scale? But I think at least, you know, for the coming cycle or two, I want to own a bunch of them. I've like entered tiny, tiny starter positions on some of these names, but I still think we kind of got a recession ahead of us in 2024. So not all in just yet.
Dang, I want a little more hope. You said you debunked the happening, and then you also said we're going to recession. So that's a little freaky there for mining friends out there. What do you think about like the concentration of some of these mining stocks? The one thing that was interesting to me is seeing like the lack of miners going public after 2022. I think the only one that's really been able to like get through since Core Scientific was Bitdeer. And they went public earlier this year, and they had already done a lot of the applications prior, right? They had teamed up with a group called like Safari Blue or something like that, some SPAC deal. And so they were able to get it through after like a lot of delays. But it does seem like a lot of the capital has been concentrated between like a few market leaders, like your Marathon Digitals and Riot's of the world. And at the same time, we have some of these other people kind of popping up, like Clean Sparks and others, and Iris Energy, I think you should throw in there too. Any thoughts on how that's working, or anything from like the research team that you've been working on looking into how these mining stocks are operating like in the public space? Because it does seem like the mind share, if you will, is really focused on like two or three miners out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the smaller names are pretty interesting, just from like kind of a trading perspective. The liquidity is very, very much concentrated into the Riots and Marathons of the world. You know, like also they kind of are like a fan favorite in some of like the Wall Street Bets circles, and have like, you know, much more like liquid option chains, which is another kind of debate. They're also like frequent just because of their size and relative liquidity compared to the rest. They're also like, you know, kind of with Coinbase favorites from like the short baskets for some of the, you know, kind of like the hyper volatile public names, not just in crypto, but kind of in like tech broadly, if you want to think of it like that. So, I mean, I think it's fine. It's nothing to worry about. You know, there'll probably be some smaller names just because of liquidity and just because of, you know, probably mispriced valuations that, you know, go bonkers and outperform the bigger names in the bull. But, you know, some of these miners, right, like for instance, a CleanSpark, a Marathon as well, have, you know, despite their share price, like, you know, you look at the chart, pull it up in linear terms, it doesn't look great. I've done a fantastic job of like using public markets to their advantage, with, you know, share dilution, which obviously isn't great for shareholders in the short term. But if they can, you know, build out a, you know, a pretty solid fleet, you know, an operational fleet of ASICs to prime for the bull market, then, you know, good for them, and they have every right to do so. And so, you know, like if you just look at the market cap of like a Marathon, and then you look at like the share price, the market cap, the chart of the market cap looks a lot better, right? Which is because of that share dilution. And so, yeah, I, you know, I'm really, I guess one of the things I'm interested to see is, you know, if this time will be different from a cycle perspective with all these miners, and, you know, do they load up on loans and Bitcoin collateralized loans and ASIC collateralized loans at the top again, or into the top, or do the, you know, the kind of the risk management regimes get a little bit more prudent? So we'll have to see, but I think there's some interesting vehicles out there to, you know, hedge this risk next time. You know, hash rate derivative products, Luxor, Blockgreen, those sort of things.
Definitely. Okay, we finish up talking about some network metrics. So right now it's pretty bad from a hash price perspective. We're at lows of like about 0.06 cents. And then in terms of like total network hash rate, we're like over 400x a hash. From your purview as like an asset manager or someone who's like in that line of work, what kind of metrics do you look at, and what are some things that are like either bullish or bearish for looking into mining stocks or just miners in general?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a boring answer, but you know, hash price is the drift of the direction, the trend of hash price is you know, I think one of the most simple but effective metrics for kind of looking at where or how miners are trading. Obviously, the main input besides hash rate in that is price. And because of, you know, hash rate's long-term drift going up because of, you know, increasing ASIC efficiency, as well as, you know, increasing economic incentive. But, you know, as these ASIC, because of Moore's law, become more efficient, these semiconductors become better and better, hash rate continues to just go up and up in exponential fashion. I guess it's actually tapered off a bit from like the, you know, 2013-14 era. But so, you know, in that case, you look at hash price in Bitcoin terms or dollar terms, it's always near all-time lows unless it's a bull market. I think one of the interesting metrics to look at is, and we only have about, you know, two cycles, maybe even a cycle and a half for a lot of these miners, is you just look at hash price increase from all-time lows. So and like it's the opposite of like, you know, the usual kind of metric for a lot of different kind of financial stuff of like drawdown from all-time highs. Well, hash price, it's like bounce from all-time lows. And if you just look at the bounce from all-time lows and then like these miners' performance, it's like, you know, kind of you basically see the manifestation of these like massive bull cycles. And with that, you know, it's basically timing the Bitcoin market, right? So it's like, it's you know, but the interesting thing here is once the bull market happens, once all of these miners go bonkers, we see a fairly common pattern, and it's pretty intuitive, where regardless of what price does, right, price goes up, down, sideways, and, you know, usually after price goes parabolic, we see a bust. But regardless of that happening, because of this massive, massive increase in the price of Bitcoin and the massive increase in these mining stocks and the massive increase in incentive to mine Bitcoin, you see like a 1 to 2, 2.5 year lag of like a metric ton of hash rate come online. And so I think that's where a lot of these miners, you know, some of them will outpace the growth, the network growth in hash rate, and some of them won't. But aside from like the Bitcoin price drawing down, is that's where like, you know, a lot of these kind of like weaker miners get wrecked, right? Is that, you know, they don't actually outpace, whether it's because of, you know, mistimed purchases or poor treasury management, they don't outpace the growth in hash rate. And then, you know, along with like the Bitcoin native revenue, along kind of going back to our security budget debate, the Bitcoin native revenue going down, right, with each halving until a certain point, likely, but at least, you know, for the interim, these miners get wrecked because they don't keep up with the hash rate. Their Bitcoin denominated revenue each halving cycle goes down. Their dollar revenue, if the price of Bitcoin busts 70%, gets wrecked too. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to playing like this bull cycle in a lot of these names. And, you know, hate to say it, but I'm also looking forward to, as dangerous as it is, to play the short leg a bit after, because I think honestly, I'm expecting a massive bubble in these miners. Like, you know, Bitcoin has its bubble cycle, and we're all pretty familiar with that. But I think just we're gonna see some crazy reflexivity and narratives and kind of mainstream media buzz in some of these miner names, and like there will be, just like there always kind of is, but there will be some like, I, you know, thoughts or ideas of is this a new paradigm? Like, you know, these miners are money printers, and you know, they're gonna, some of these maybe newer names, maybe there's another new IPO cycle, they're gonna get leveraged up, and there's gonna, you know, they're gonna draw down 80-90% again, and that's probably a few years out, but just kind of how I think about it.
So just to like clarify there, or maybe get some more info, you're thinking it could be bigger than last cycle, because like Core Scientific was pretty impressive, right? It kind of speaks to what you're saying there, like really leveraged and then went up and went down really hard and fast. So you're thinking that there's going to be more money coming in next cycle, because you're just thinking there's going to be more institutions next cycle and they're going to want to deploy capital into mining?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's been talk for a while. It hasn't really manifested, at least, you know, on the margins it has, but there's been talk about like, you know, the energy producers kind of getting involved in a bigger way. Maybe like, you know, some people thought in the bear market, we'd see some like mergers, acquisitions. We really didn't see that all that much. You know, it's more been kind of like on the private side, it's like, oh, you know, Exxon, they don't really talk about it, but they're mining Bitcoin, you know, with like their flared methane, but they don't even keep the Bitcoin. They just sell it and take the dollars. And it's like nothing to them, right? It's like not even worth mentioning because they print billions upon billions of dollars a quarter. So like, you know, I do think the bubble will be bigger. You know, there's obviously going to be more names and some will, you know, crazy outperform and some won't. But, you know, regardless of the timeline, like people think that, you know, the 2024 timing Bitcoin cycle is an absolute lock. Like, I'm not saying it's not going to happen. I just don't think it's a certainty. But regardless, Bitcoin's naturally very cyclical. The supply is more primed than, you know, it's ever been as a percent of its outstanding supply. Just in terms of like, you know, the Bitcoin being held, right? Like 95% of Bitcoin didn't move in the last month. That's never happened before, ever. Yeah. So like supply is extremely inelastic. It's just a matter of if you have flows. And right now, like just being straight up, there's no flows. There's no buy side flows into Bitcoin. I mean, there's some, right? Like the sat stackers, like I know. but like the institutional capital, like the talks of like, oh, well, like front run the ETF. Well, everybody that's like talking about front running ETF and like the people on Bitcoin Twitter or crypto Twitter, like they're mostly deployed. Like just, you know, being straight up, like the people that are like hyper bullish Bitcoin, like they're not sitting in 95% cash. They're sitting like aggressively, however, you know, their aggressive allocation to Bitcoin is their position, right? So like there's no one front running ETF flows or, you know, potential ETF flows. Those flows will be the, you know, I guess front running of sorts. It's not priced in if and when it comes. And I actually don't even think if an ETF, when an ETF is approved, it's not like an absolute guaranteed lock that the, you know, immediately buy, you know, $10 billion of Bitcoin right away. Like that's very much interdependent on how bad the business cycle is, whether we get a recession, right? Like if NASDAQ is dumping and everything's risk off and the dollar's soaring, like, you know, the flows into Bitcoin aren't going to be all that strong, at least temporarily. Right. Yeah. And like there's a natural cycle there. But I think these are some of the narratives that, you know, maybe get people a little bit caught off sides in 2024. Maybe not. But I'm pretty certain, you know, very certain that regardless of the timeline, this natural kind of bubble phase will happen again. And at that point, I want to be aggressively long the miners.
Wow. We got a bear on the show. But I like your long term thesis. Dylan, thanks so much for joining the show. I don't know if you have any. I think everyone probably follows you already on Twitter, so we don't have to shill that. But like anything in the future that we should be paying attention to or something coming up in the near future?
Yeah, just follow me on Twitter. You know, maybe catch my next 3-minute video series or something. Well, looking forward to that. But no, I appreciate you having me on. It was good to kind of go back and forth on some of this more in the weeds kind of debate. Probably good to get my more than 3-minute long view on things out there as well. So I'll be sharing this.
Cool. Thanks, Dylan.
Cheers, man.